ranked, right? Really from the top to the bottom. I remember really struggling with competing against my friends who become your family, by the way. You have to compete for the top position. And I do remember having an aha moment saying, this isn't sustainable. The energy can't be about competing with people that I love, that I respect. And I reframed it. It was about competing with myself. If I could be better than I was yesterday, last week, last month, if I can fully apply myself, I'll do well and I'll achieve what I'm meant to achieve. Reframe it about competing against yourself. And there's always a positive outcome.
Great companies are all about the people. Good people become great leaders, mentors for work and life.
Welcome to Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. I'm Roman Segal, recovering marketer.
And I'm Andrew Tarvin, humor engineer. Roman and I both got our start at P&G, the Procter & Gamble company, where we had the opportunity to work with some amazing people. And as you may know, many leaders across industries got their start at P&G. In this series, through conversations with fellow P&G alums, we hope to go deeper with the leaders you already know, but want to know more about.
It's kind of like being a fly on the wall for my mentoring coffees.
On today's show, we're talking to P&G alumni leader Michelle Crossan, who is the Senior Vice President of Corporate Strategy, Innovation, and Transformation at Samsung Electronics America. It was a great conversation about being your best self. Here's a quick bio on Michelle. Michelle Crossan is the Senior Vice President of Corporate Strategy, Innovation, and Transformation at Samsung Electronics America, where she leads overall corporate strategy, innovation, transformation, and new business incubation. Prior to Samsung, she served as CMO for Virtu and held global and regional brand leadership roles at Procter & Gamble. Michelle has worked across a variety of business cultures, geographies, and industry sectors such as technology, consumer electronics, private equity, luxury, beauty, and FMCG. And she has led brand strategy and marketing offices. She is also married with two children and a resident of New Jersey. Now, a few things that stood out to me from our conversation is the first, the importance of intention. Michelle shares multiple examples of times that she's spent some dedicated time to really focusing on what she wants and how to get there. Not only that, she talks about how she brings her whole family into the process as well, even with her kids who are only 7 and 9 years old. But to her point, she's like, you can never start too early with the importance of envisioning. She also shares her approach to not only overcoming imposter syndrome, but also what we as leaders can do to strengthen and encourage our teams. But perhaps my favorite part was her advice on what leaders can do right now to help their teams manage the challenges of today's current environment. This wasn't theoretical and concepts and all, but rather very actionable ideas that anyone, almost any leader, could implement starting tomorrow. And her tip for how to end a Friday is immediately going into my strategies. So I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation with Michelle. So let's jump right in. Today, we're talking to Michelle Crossan, who is the Senior Vice President of Corporate Strategy, Innovation, and Transformation at Samsung Electronics America. Michelle, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you here.
Well, hello, and thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
I'm super excited to be chatting with you as well to hear about your experiences because you've got quite a fantastic background. And for the people who aren't familiar with your professional story, you graduated from the University of Strathclyde Business School and started working at Procter & Gamble first as a systems analyst. Then you made your way up and then you moved into marketing, working on brands such as Olay and Anna Sui before becoming a brand manager and then brand leader for P&G Prestige. And then you moved to Virtu as the chief marketing officer there before now joining Samsung, where you're at this point, the senior vice president of corporate strategy, innovation, and transformation. So my very first question for you is, when you were growing up in Glasgow, Scotland, was that the career you would imagined you would have?
Absolutely not. How funny is that? I always dreamed of a fabulous career. I always dreamed of a job in business. I don't think I ever imagined that I would have the opportunity to work in beauty care or work in, you know, luxury like in Virtu or even in Samsung or Korean companies. So it really has surprised me. And I've thoroughly enjoyed the journey, I must admit.
Yeah, well, I think that's part of life, right, is the journey that it takes. And so when you were growing up, though, when you were a little kid, what did you imagine you would grow up to become? Something in business? Or were you like, you know, dreams of an astronaut or princess or anything else? What was that young you? What were you thinking of?
I think that's a great question, because I always ask people, what did you want to be when you were younger, when you grow up? And I loved watching movies. So Wall Street was was a movie that I watched as a kid. And I just, you know, I wanted to be in business. I wanted to make money. I wanted to be independent. And it kind of made me think about, like, okay, what I need to do to get that. And that's when I figured out, oh, I better go to a good school. Oh, I better get good grades. Because the life that I imagined, you know, it required a go forward plan that, you know, a lot of work was required to get there, right?
That's right. And so is that what kind of sent you down the engineering degree route at university?
John, it's funny. The university course that I took actually had two sides to it. It was manufacturing engineering and management sciences, which is another term for consulting. And what I loved about the engineer and the consultant side, it was logical. It was about solutions, problems, and finding solutions. And so in my head, I never really thought about it as engineering. I thought about it as, okay, there's a challenge in the production facilities. How are we going to solve it? And I guess that's where I started to really enjoy problems and solution, right? Development, really, from those early days.
Yeah, well, and I think that's something that I, as an engineer, so my background is computer science and engineering, and I certainly resonate with that idea of solving problems. In fact, I joke, and this I learned from P&G terminology, is I don't think of them as math problems, but math opportunities.
Yeah, totally right. It's a challenge. It's an opportunity.
Exactly. It's an opportunity to solve some type of problem. And so I'm curious, from those early moments or early career, was there anything that kind of stands out to you as an important lesson that you learned along the way?
Oh gosh, there were so many lessons. And I must say, so many lessons in P&G. I mean, P&G is the ultimate school and we all know that. But I think pre-P&G was where really my informative years that got me ready for the P&G, and that's where P&G finessed it. I mean, the early years of my life, I didn't grow up in an area, you know, I grew up in Glasgow, Scotland. I didn't grow up in an area where people went to university. My parents were, you know, unemployed. There was a lot of alcoholism around where I grew up. And so the conversation of which college you were going to, that did not happen in the streets of where I grew up in Glasgow. And so what I learned really early on in life was about creating a vision for yourself. And how ironic, one of the things P&G teaches you, right, really early on in leadership, I don't know, remember the course in P&G, improve your personal leadership. One of the first of the five E's was to envision. And so I think that was one of the very first lessons I really learned in my early life, was you got to create a vision for yourself, for your life. And then as I evolved in business, it was, you know, what's your vision for your business and where you want to take it? So that happened very early on. And that was probably through adversity, probably through realizing you don't want something and you want something to be in a better position, if you know what I mean.
Oh, definitely. I think sometimes, yeah, us learning what we don't want becomes more important than finding what we do want, because the what we don't want informs what we do want. And so as you think back to that now, as you think back to the vision that you had growing up, do you think that you've kind of met that? Has it changed along the way? Is it still kind of pretty similar? Because you've at least been, at least on the outside perspective, I would say, very successful at that idea of being successful in business.
Do you know, it's funny you ask that, because I was on a flight recently, which not many of us have been. That in itself was different. And we hit major turbulence. And anyone who knows, when you hit major turbulence, you say your little prayers. And mm-hmm. It really was a moment where I was like, you know what? I'm really happy. I thank God for all the opportunities I've been given. And I really thank all the love and friends that I've made over the years. And if it was to end in that moment of terrible turbulence, I'm okay. But, you know, it doesn't mean that there isn't a different vision coming. You know, I'm in my mid-40s now, and it's like, okay, I've achieved what I wanted to when I was 12, 13. But that was because, you know, my world could only dream so big. My world only knew through movies and whatever what could be possible. But now that I've lived and moved across the world, I spent a lot of time in London and Geneva and Frankfurt and now New York, and I start to see different opportunities. So I'm starting to develop a new vision. I just haven't really, it's fuzzy vision, I would call it.
Well, and I think that I what a great kind of point to make is that sometimes, you know, we're limited by our vision is limited by our experiences or the things around us, and that are it should change over time as we get new input and feedback. So I love that it's still kind of this kind of evolution. And so I'm curious because, you know, you start at P&G in the systems analyst side, which if I'm correct is more of the IT type space. Is that right?
Yeah, it was IT. Yeah.
Yep. Because I was systems analyst as well at IT. But then you made the move to marketing. Was there a specific reason why you wanted to do that? You wanted to work on a specific brand or wanted a different challenge? What prompted that change?
Well, I always knew that I wanted to work in business and I wanted to own a P&L. I wanted to run the business. But I remember I had a passion for problem solving. And I love just that whole solution process. So when I understood what IT was in those days in P&G, it really was about driving solutions in our own internal systems, SAP, supply chain, etc. And it was, you know, Michelle Hughes, a great, great leader in P&G, convinced me to join IT, and I loved every minute of it. Then another great Michelle appeared in my life called Michelle D'Aldring, and she was a VP in beauty care at the time. And I met Michelle and a few other great ladies at a Women Supporting Women. Actually, I think they renamed it to People Supporting People course. And that, again, was the early days of the diversity movement. And you spend 3-4 days in Devon, and it was just outside Geneva. And I started to really get that itch again. I love what I'm doing in IT, but I feel like I'm off course because I'm not following the Wall Street vision I had, which is to run my own P&L. And this is where Michelle D'Aldry said, I think you'd either be great in sales or marketing. I'm running Olay, and I think there could be space for you. And I interviewed with a few of the leaders, and I'm not joking when I say 4 months later, I was sitting in Geneva working in marketing as an ABM, and it was the best move ever. You know, I joke about it. I moved to the dark side. It was the best move ever because I really felt like I was home. I was with really like-minded people that had the same passions that I had.
Which I think is great. I think one, it speaks to kind of the values of just relationships in general that someone can kind of, hey, you would be a good fit here in helping to bridge that gap. And I'm curious, were there skills that you learned from the IT or from that kind of mindset of solving problems that transferred very well into marketing? Because I don't have that experience in marketing. It seems to me in some ways that they might be relatively different, but maybe there's some similarities.
So funny you ask that because, you know, I still draw on my learnings from my IT days in my job now, even in Samsung, because I have an arm under me in Samsung, which is a program management office, right? So the best PMOs out there will work in this office. And I still talk about the quadrant of project management that I was taught at the age of 21 in P&G. Scope, time, cost, quality. For anyone of those are listening, we all remember project management training in P&G. And in IT, it was great because it was all about frameworks of how to solve problems and how to really run projects. Those skills I took right into marketing when I was leading initiatives, and then I've taken into Vertu when I was a CMO. I now still talk about it in my Samsung role. And I draw up the little quadrant. I draw it up all the time. Guys, I have a little quadrant to share. And we all have choices, scope, time, cost, quality. So it just shows you how impactful those trainings we received in our early days in our career. You know, I think about brand manager college, project management, improve your personal leadership, 80-20. All of these trainings I still refer to today as I'm coaching my own people.
Oh, certainly. I do that the same thing. And I love like that articulation even just of, you know, IT is about solving problems and how to run projects. And that is something that does apply across all of these different areas. And I think it's also important recognition because we have some of the people who are listening are maybe exploring or thinking about a career change, either in terms of a new company or maybe even a new industry or function. And kind of to your point, it doesn't mean that the things that you've done before here aren't going to be applicable. It's just that you find how to use them in a new context, maybe.
Oh, totally. And I remember when I was meeting my last boss there, the former CEO of Samsung US, Wai Chom, and he was interviewing me for my first role in Europe. And I remember using the brand building framework. And it was all about the who, consumers, boss, etc. And it was so impressive how he really appreciated that perspective that P&G had taught us, we were able to look at things very differently. And it's great to see now in Samsung where you start to see the same concepts today. You know, consumer is king, first moment, second moment of truth, etc. You know what I'm talking about. It's now really as we see our leaders leaving P&G and get into companies, we start to influence the way of thinking and how to build the brands, how to build experiences, etc.
Oh, certainly. Well, and I think that, you know, even though I spent my entire career on the IT side at P&G, there's still a lot of marketing that, you know, came over like with even on the IT side. And I worked in the prestige space as well for in New York. Yeah, in the New York office on the IT, running some of the stuff for the sales side. And I'm curious because that was a particularly kind of challenging environment to be in because P&G didn't own the brands outright. There was a lot of work that had to be done with fashion houses and other things. How did you find that experience of collaboration where you have to appease not only P&G and the P&L on that side of things, but you have a fashion house that you have to keep happy and you have to have the, you know, the ultimately the consumers happy as well. How did you find that balance?
Such a fabulous question. It's funny, right? You ask anyone who worked in prestige, we all felt like we owned the brands we worked on. It's that accountability and leadership that even though it was a licensed brand, we felt the ownership. But the key thing in prestige, what it taught us was how to manage complex stakeholders, not just internal ones that most, you know, P&G folk will master, but the external ones, which really sets you up for a career as you, you know, exit, say you're working with a board, etc. Being able to understand what really matters to them and marry up what really matters to P&G and what really matters to the consumer. But fundamentally, do you know what it always came down to? If the consumer loved it, most parties would agree on it. Because no matter if you're a fashion house, no matter if you're a P&G, at the end of the day, it really matters what the consumer wants. Because if the consumer doesn't like it, of course, we won't make our sales. And but it was funny, eh? How everyone still really felt like they owned their brand.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like, well, and I think that's a key to, maybe it's a mentality that of certain types of people that work at P&G, but that ownership of your work and the things that you're working on, I feel like is such a valuable, you know, way of being and work. And so I'm curious, and the roles that you've had as a leader, how have you kind of tried to create that sense of ownership for members on your team?
Oh, that's a great question. So I am obsessed by doing my own trainings, my own coaching of my own people. And so talk to them about extreme ownership. I love Jocko. Anyone who reads Jocko, extreme ownership, because really it comes down to what we own. We can't control other people. We can only control our own actions and our own impact. And this is where, you know, you buy the books, you do. I do book clubs. Don't laugh at me. You know, I'll host my own little book clubs. I'll do my own tea sessions, you know, lady tea sessions, where we can really talk about the concepts and what's holding you back. Because everyone agrees on the theory. Most people agree 80% on the theory. But there's always something that's a limiting belief that will hold you back. And once you know what that, and by the way, figuring out that limiting belief is really hard. Mm-hmm. And people need to do a lot of soul searching for that. But then once you figure it out, it's a lot easier, obviously, to tackle it because then you know what it is and then you can go after it. A lot of people, though, and what I've found interesting is that people don't think they're worthy sometimes. Some people think I'm too junior. I don't have a big enough team, blah, 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 blah. And what I realized in this Improve Your Personal Leadership course, which I got years ago, by the way, in Newcastle, I'm talking 20 years ago, this taught us that leadership starts with you and that you didn't need a team. And that was why it's all about personal leadership. And it's really important that people feel like it doesn't matter what level you are, you can lead and influence anything. Because really, it's about a movement. It's about a movement. It's about a vision. And it's about engaging people behind that vision. And it could be from a huge thing to a small thing. But leadership conceptually is about getting people to believe in something and to get them to act in a way that they feel compelled to. And so that's what we do. And it really is dedicating time to coach and train that. You know, for instance, in Samsung, every month, a Friday morning, we dedicate to training. We have our own like extra training curriculum that we create ourselves. Samsung has a massive Samsung U training, whatever. But on top of that, I carve out dedicated time to training in the morning, every Friday, once a month. And that makes a difference because then you can bring in other experts who have a different take on the subject. And then people can formulate their own approach. But it's about dedicating time to it.
I love so much of what you've said there. I mean, the book club idea, I think, is fantastic as a way to, like you said, people agree 80% on the theory, but what is that? What's the application piece? How does it actually fit for you? And I think you're so right about that limiting belief. And so I'm curious, like you said, it is kind of challenging. How did you, like, is there a limiting belief out there that you've kind of had to resolve yourself? And how did you discover it was a limiting belief? And how are you working towards not letting it hold you back?
I think, let's face it, imposter syndrome hits a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And I just hosted a ladies coaching session on it. And it's ironic, right? There's, you know, most shrinks, you know, are really helping themselves when they meet clients. Yeah. I feel like I was helping myself as much as the other ladies around the WebEx. And I guess I've had imposter syndrome for years, which spurred me on, but it took a lot of energy because of my early start in life. I didn't go to the most prestigious university. I didn't go to the best school per se, but I'm sitting in a privileged seat. And so sometimes that little voice, you know, you've got the good voice and the bad voice, that little voice would go, you're not worthy. And so I spent a lot of time trying to understand the imposter syndrome, going on my own courses, you know, just watching webinars. They're great. Take some time out and get in some techniques and practicing. And then also with my children, especially my son. So my son does something that he knows isn't perfect, you know, isn't right. We'll talk, was that good savvy or bad savvy talking? And we give bad savvy, wee savvy a nickname. And it makes him feel comfortable, like recognizing there's just a little wee voice encouraging him to do things that he shouldn't do. And it's the same for me. And so Sheryl Sandberg, very inspired by what she talks about in Lean In. I watch a lot of Oprah. And Oprah, you can't beat Oprah. And then Untamed. Have you heard about the book Untamed?
I have not. No.
Oh, Untamed, Glennon Doyle. It's a movement. It's a movement. And it's all about women really just getting rid of those shackles and really coming into their own skin and just eliminating that imposter syndrome. So I highly recommend to anyone listening, get the Untamed book. Glennon Doyle's written 3 books. That's the last of the trilogy. You know, if you can, do all 3. But they say, you know, the first 2 books started the conversation and the last book started a movement. How great is that?
Oh, that's so great. I mean, not only read the book, but maybe start a book club. I love the idea of being able to have the conversation about it. And I think, like you said, imposter syndrome is so right. I think, I imagine many of our listeners have that sense of either it's preventing them from taking a chance on something that they want to do, or maybe they're in a recent new promotion or other job and you feel it. For me, one of the things that's really helped with imposter syndrome is improvisation. I started doing improv in university, and a lot of the tenets of improv of yes and treat your, you know, fellow players like poets and geniuses and all that kind of stuff. It's a great way to practice, put into practice some of the things that you're talking about, rather than, like you said, just the theory piece. How do you actually get a chance to practice it?
That's brilliant. And by the way, it's funny you talk about that, but it's because it's talking about people who experience, you know, imposter syndrome. But you know, one thing my former boss, Wai Chom, used to do, he would always tap the chair next to him, go sit there. He always invited me. He always gave me a seat at the table. And that's one of the things I've started to do is, like, I really observe who's contributing in meetings. And I'll give a little nudge to some of the ladies. Hey, you know, speak up. You know, it's a safe space. And so for the leaders who are listening, it's for us really to also reach out when we think and suspect imposter syndrome could be holding someone back and making them feel like they've got the right to have a seat at the table.
Which I think is such a powerful reminder, like you said, for the people listening. And I am curious, because that is one of the things that a number of our listeners have to deal with is bias in the workplace, whether it's because of gender, ethnicity, race, or background. And so I'm curious, in your own kind of work history, have you faced adversity because of your background? And if so, how did you deal with it?
John, I've been really blessed. P&G totally welcomed me with open arms. It was almost like, yeah, you are diverse, so we want more of that. I was very, mm-hmm. very blessed. And they helped to really educate and grow me into the leader I've become. So actually, you know, you kind of forget even where you come from sometimes in a positive way, not in a negative way. But there is something about what I did observe, and I was thinking about adversity, not just because of what you stand for. There's 2 things I want to talk about here. Is one, you can only, you give that to people. You give people the opportunity to judge you and to let it impact you. Reality is, if you feel comfortable in your own skin and you are what you are and you know your own value, you'll be in a place that really values you and makes you and will make you feel welcomed and will believe in you. The minute that doesn't happen and you try to change it and it can't change, that is one of the signs that is not a home for you. It's just not a home. Not all places can change. I'm lucky enough in PNG it was never a case. And then in Samsung, I'm leading transformation. I've got the job of being the change agent. So, and I could talk a bit about more of that later, but it really is important that you know your own value and you feel very, very comfortable in that. And then there was another thing that I wanted to mention. The time that I really did feel uncomfortable, and it was us versus them or me versus others, was a little bit of the rating process. I mean, if you can remember this in PNG, we're all ranked, right? And it really from the top to the bottom, and you know where you're ranked. Everyone finds out. And I remember at the time really struggling with competing against my friends, because who become your family, by the way. You know, just 2 minutes before joining you in this podcast, I'm speaking to one of my girlfriends that I grew up with in PNG. She lives in Geneva, I live in New York, and we're still talking, and we left PNG a long time ago, because these people become your family. But in the rankings and the ratings, obviously you have to compete for the top position. And I do remember having an aha moment, probably in my early 30s, saying, this isn't sustainable for me. The energy can't be about competing with people that I love, people that I respect in this way, for that number one spot. And I reframed it. It was about competing with myself. If I could be better than I was yesterday, last week, last month, I'll get a great rating, because, you know, I'm fully applying myself, and not everyone fully applies themselves. So if I can fully apply myself, I'll do well and I'll achieve what I'm meant to achieve and I'll be recognized as such. So I think there's two things there. Is one, feel good in your own skin. And yeah, that takes a lot of therapy for some. It takes a lot of soul searching, which, you know, I've done all that myself. And number two is just being very mindful when you're in a situation and it's about competing versus against another individual, reframe that. Reframe it about competing against yourself. And there's always a positive outcome then.
Yeah, and it's such a great, that's a great reframe. You know, I've heard it from Carol Dweck of growth mindset versus the fixed mindset.
Yeah.
Fixed mindset is you competing against other people. Growth mindset is, exactly to your point, how can I be better today than I was yesterday? So I think that's a great kind of articulation and focus and recognition to your point that not every place is going to be a home, and there's always going to be, or even if you like a certain place, there might be times to move on.
And now a quick word from our sponsor. Today, we're talking to fellow alumni entrepreneur Kyle Yamaguchi, co-founder of One for One Eyewear. One for One Eyewear is an independently owned eyewear brand that develops, designs, and distributes some great looking glasses. I'm actually wearing a pair right now. So Kyle, I got to ask, why eyewear?
Well, about 10 years ago, I was working for the man. I went to go pick up my glasses where I ended up meeting my wife. We started dating, and while we were dating, we just got to talking about maybe one day starting a business. It's always been an aspiration of mine. So she knew all about the eyewear industry. I knew all about product creations. We kind of put our two skills together and we decided to launch an eyewear brand.
What's really cool about your brand is you have an interesting giving back component to it. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so for every pair of glasses that we sell, we give a pair away to a person in need. And we're using our own brand of frames to give those back to people in the community. And we work with organizations, both large and small. So for example, we just wrapped up a clinic in Seattle, the King County Clinic. It's a huge event. And if that had been alone, we would give about 1,500 pairs of glasses. We have about 500 stores across the country, and all of the stores have the opportunity to give back our frames to people within their community. So if they have somebody in who needs a pair of glasses, maybe they can't afford it, they can direct them to our section on their wall and choose one of our frames that we'll then ship them for free. Otherwise, we could send them like a donation kit that they can use. And as they are seeing folks in need, they can offer those frames as a selection, you know, to be able to receive.
Yeah, what I love about that is it's even lower income people can almost like have greater confidence because they're wearing something that looks good, whether it's a haircut, a clean shave, a nice suit, great pair of glasses. I think it helps people feel better about themselves.
Yeah, I agree. You know, one thing that we've noticed, especially with these larger organizations, is that a lot of the frames they were giving out to people were these really old kind of frames that you would imagine like your grandma would wear, you know? And when we came in, we were able to provide, you know, very newer, and I mean, they're the same frames that we're selling in our stores across the country. So folks were able to get a really good pair of glasses, and also, like you said, you know, have more confidence as they go try to get a job or just get back in the world.
And you've been doing this for 10 years now, and you must have given away like thousands of frames by this point.
That's correct. So this is our 10-year anniversary.
Where can people find out more about One for One, Kyle?
Just go to our website, oneforoneeyewear.com. At the top, you can click on retailers, and that will give you an idea of the stores across the country where our line is available.
Great. Well, Kyle, thanks so much for doing the work you do. And now back to the show.
You made some big career choices leaving P&G and then also moving from different places, as you mentioned, Frankfurt to Geneva to London to New York. And so I'm curious, what factors go into those types of career choices?
Well, I guess the factors that go into it, is it good for my family? Because, you know, dual career with my husband. I worked with my husband for years in P&G. And so we always were very mindful, would this work for both of us? Good for my children. Will they get to live a diverse life? Will they get the most out of this? And also good for my career, my building blocks for my career. So I do have a vision of where I want to go in my career. And I recognize that there are skills required versus geographies, but more the skills and the industries that will get me there. And so for me, that's very important. But there is another important point. And I heard about it today, and I heard it reminds me today in another alumni event. And that was about choosing your boss. And when you find that there's a boss there that will bring out the best in you, really, really fortunate. I've had great bosses throughout my P&G history, Mike Dooley, Keith Carrison, you name it, all such great bosses. And then Wai Chom in Samsung, it felt like I was coming home. I felt like I really could be me. And so those were all factors. But it was interesting when I was considering the move to the States from Europe, I remember meeting one of my coach mentors, Alex Inchbold, and we were unsure, is this the right thing to do? And he said, okay, in 3 years' time, what could you possibly achieve? And we mapped it all out, my husband and I, and we talked about the kids, learning more Spanish, being closer to my husband's home in Puerto Rico, blah, 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 blah. And we're like, okay, good. This makes sense. But it was because he reminded us that it's just like a business. Set your KPIs and work towards it. And it made us feel, it really unleashed us and unlocked us so that we really felt very excited about the opportunity.
I love that. I'm just imagining you sitting around the dinner table with your husband and your kids talking about KPIs. I'm like, all right, now what's your KPI, son? What's your KPI?
Well, you know, we always joke about Proctor kids. They get it.
Exactly. Yeah. They align on whether they're going to do their homework or not, or they're following like all of that, that language. And well, I love that how clear that is though, right? That it is, like you said, career, family, and specifically like children. Does it help you achieve that vision? What a great thing to bring them into part of that conversation, right? Because it's not just a decision that impacts you, but the entire group of people. And I'm curious, you know, as a mother of two, what would you say your children have learned from you so far? What would you hope they have learned from you?
Do you know, I was teaching them about how to envision recently, how to create a vision and how to do strategies. And they're 7 and 9, right? But I thought if you start young, hey, they start young, they'll get it. But in all seriousness, right? You know, I do touch on little topics like that because I do think it's smart just to drop it in now. But really, for me, it's about really having a vision for what they want. So my kids are ski racers, but they're also, my daughter in particular is really musical and performs in a band at the age of 9. And so for her, it's about going, okay, that's my vision. That's what I want to achieve. And what are my building blocks and my plans to get there? Do you know what? See if they could just take that away. It will set them up for life, right? Because they're always going to, no matter what problem or what anything they're going to tackle, that they'll have a framework to draw back on. But what I'm really trying to tap into right now as well, on top of that, is having passion and being in a space where it taps into your passion and building grit. And building grit for me is probably the hardest thing. If you think about it, I grew up in just the most adverse childhood ever. You know, my mom died really young. I had an alcoholic father. Everyone was unemployed, sick, whatever. There was just no light at the end of the tunnel. So you had, it was the most blessed opportunity to learn grit. You know, and if you didn't learn grit, you were just going to be left on the sidelines. So that was something, resilience and grit, I learned just because of my life circumstances. My children don't have the same life circumstances. And yeah, I'm happy that they're blessed that they don't have that. But how are they going to learn grit and resilience if they don't have the same life circumstances? So I'm trying to facilitate in ways where they can learn that, but not live the life that I have lived and still have the great life. And that, my friend, is hard. That's one I haven't figured out yet completely.
Which, yeah, I can understand that challenge, right? Because I think that's the goal of many parents, is to be able to move up a social class perhaps, or whatever, to be able to give their kids the things that they didn't have, and so that they don't have to go through those same challenging experiences. But at the same time, yeah, you don't want them to feel like everything's been given to them on a silver platter or whatever. So I imagine a challenging balance between the two.
It is. It's not easy. It's not easy. And you know, there's so many theories out there. Do you give your kids, do you pay them for tasks? Do you not? I mean, honestly, it's just so wildly varying, the advice out there on how to raise kids. It seems like it's probably easier to turn around a $30 billion business than it is to raise two kids. And so I genuinely do think about all, you know, I'm really lucky. I'm surrounded by a lot of great leaders and parents in my Samsung world today. And you know, in these little, and these groups that we have, we have an ERG called Women in Samsung, and we'll have sessions and we'll talk about this. And it doesn't matter what level you are, doesn't matter where you come from, the challenges of parenting and mothering seem to be universal, and we all help each other. It's kind of beautiful to see.
Well, and I think it's a recognition too of like how important it is to be able to have those types of conversations. It's the human aspect of it, of like, because that impacts your work, right? If you're able to do that well, then you're able to give maybe the time and energy that you need to your role. If you're not able to do that well, then it's going to impact whether or not you like. So it's not just good kind of thing to do because it's a nice human thing, but it's also probably a good business strategy.
Yeah. I remember speaking to someone from another company. It was about a couple of years ago. And you know, it was on one of those diversity conferences in New York. And the lady told me, you know, sometimes I can't go on business trips because I can't afford childcare. And it was just something that I'd never really considered before. And, you know, and I was just thinking, oh, we're so lucky. In Samsung, you know, we have policies that really protect female people as they emerge through their career, where, you know, they have to stay overnight or whatever. You know, we've got these policies for backup childcare, et cetera, but not everyone has that, right? And it just made me realize, you know, how fortunate. And so we need to always, well, we always put our hand out there and try and help others along their journey, because it's not as easy.
Yeah. And one, I think that's one of the questions I'm curious about from your perspective, because you kind of mentioned like some of the things that we can do. What can leaders be doing in addition to looking at some of those policies, in addition to what you mentioned a little bit earlier of like being the type of person that is checking in on people if they do have imposter syndrome, encouraging them, anything else that people can really be doing to create this type of more supportive and uplifting environment that we could benefit from?
Listen, you know, especially right now, we talk about the COVID blues. So people are feeling isolated. I'll talk about the here and now versus in general, because the here and now is painful for a lot of people. We notice, at least in my immediate team, people had the COVID blues. And it's this back-to-back, you know, Zoom, WebEx calls, people feeling really under pressure. So we banned meetings during lunchtime. That was one thing. People need to take a break and they need to eat. But more importantly, if you have children, you got to feed them lunch. There's just some basics you have to do, right? So we kind of banned lunches, which may sound a bit like crazy, but you started to see people being a little bit happier in the afternoon because they had eaten. How crazy is that? They had eaten. We were hearing stories that people weren't eating to 6 o'clock at night. They were starving themselves because they couldn't get to it. So banned that. Another thing as well, leaders need to walk the talk. I don't work late hours at night. So you won't get emails from me after 7 o'clock at night, and you won't get emails from me at the weekends, because I genuinely, genuinely believe that rest triggers innovation. I believe you need to live a life to innovate in life. So if all I'm doing is writing emails, how can I possibly see what's going on with the world and feel inspired about what my product innovation team's doing? Because I'm just like internally focused. So getting the rest at night, getting the rest in the weekend, making sure your teams feel empowered, making sure your teams have time for trainings like we do Friday mornings, and then no meetings on Friday afternoon so that people can close the week with a win. You know, when you close your computer at 7 o'clock on Friday night and you've got 100 emails still to answer, do you feel good about that? Or do you feel really good about clearing your email and knowing that you achieved ABC? And that's what we're trying to do, is make people feel good about what they have achieved versus what they haven't achieved. Now, that's just things I'm doing, and I'm starting to see morale really improve. But the reality is, you know, there are greater impacts on our morale that we can control in the workplace. But we doesn't mean that we can't start with something small and try and help each other.
Oh, well, and that's what I really like about each of those ideas is absolutely there's, you know, more to, there's the bigger picture of solving different injustices and all of those that like need to be addressed. But also there's something nice about the actionability of each one of these sayings is, as a leader, can you say no lunchtime meeting so that people actually eat food? I love what you're saying. Like, yeah, people are in a better mood if they've actually had some food. And the fact that you're saying that, you know, walking the talk, I think becomes very important, because that's oftentimes how culture is defined in an organization. You know, on our side, when we're talking about humor in the workplace, which is what we train, the number one reason why people don't use more humor at work is because they don't think that their boss or coworkers would approve. Because they're not seeing it from them. But if they see it, I imagine, you know, as you do these things, as you're saying, hey, I'm not working over the weekend. Hey, we're not going to have meetings on Fridays. It's a great following that philosophy of the peak end principles, where people tend to remember the peak of an experience and the end of it. So you apply that to a week. I love that, because the end, if you've ended on a win Friday afternoon, you're going to feel better, look back at the entire week and feel better about it.
Yeah, totally. And it really, there's another thing that I didn't mention actually in reflecting about it. We do a lot. So we've got multiple ERGs that are helping us with diversity and inclusion. And one of the things that we realize that really drives people's engagement is the sense of belonging, really feeling like you belong and the values you have are shared with the company. We've all felt that with P&G, you know, that sense of belong, we're a part of it. And in Samsung, we have people that work just as long in Samsung as they do in P&G careers, you know, and you see that. And so really, for a team leader or a division leader or whatever, making your people feel like they belong and that you really value them in your own way, however you want to do it, is really critical, especially in these times.
I love it. I think that's a great reminder. And so I'm curious, as we start to wrap up from today, we have a couple of kind of quicker questions just to get to know you a little bit more. And we're talking a little bit about that idea of taking a time to take a break. So what's your go-to form of escape? Is it watching movies, reading books, seeing something on TV, something else?
Reading books. I've got a whole bookcase right next to me. Right now.
Okay. And what's a book that you, so yeah, that's clear. You do the book club, et cetera, as well. And in addition to Untamed, which we already got a fantastic recommendation there. So I'm going to force you to come up with another one, another book that you've recently maybe gifted to a friend or feel like more people should read.
Oh, right. So I read about 4 books every morning because, you know, I do the 5 a.m. club. I wake up outrageously early. I read The Daily Stoic. I love that. I love Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, really amazing. And because what they do is they make you think really differently, like, mm-hmm. you know, make you think and step back and understand, listen, we only live once and it's a short life, so you better really enjoy it. So I highly recommend those 2 books, but The Daily Stoic is a classic, right? That's easy to read, one passage a day, and it makes you really think. It's thought-provoking and will set you up for a good day.
Oh, I like it. That's a great way to start the morning. And what's a fact about you that surprises people? So for example, for me, despite how nerdy I am, I'm actually a solid dancer.
Oh, you're a dancer. Brilliant. Well, I'm Scottish and I can dance salsa, which really throws people off. Ooh. When I go to Puerto Rico and they're like, oh my goodness, she can dance. I don't dance very well, though. I have to put it out there, but I still dance it, right?
Exactly. You still do it. That's the key. I feel like that's the like 90% of at least like more casual dancing is just having the willingness or the confidence to do it. And who is someone out there that you would love to grab coffee with?
Oh, you're going to laugh. You're going to laugh. It goes between Jane Fonda or Dolly Parton. I love these 2 iconic ladies. They're just so important in our feminist movement for different reasons, right? But I do love Dolly.
Oh, man. I can imagine. I mean, I imagine a three-person conversation between the three of you would be an epic, epic conversation.
That would be awesome, though.
Excellent. Well, we have one last question for you as you are like starting to close out. What is one final piece of advice that you would give to the next generation of leaders?
Yeah, I would say wake up early. You know, there's this classic saying, win the morning, win the day. I get up anytime between 4:30, 5:00, and I do my meditation, my gratitude journal, I read. And by the time my kids wake up, I'm completely zened. But more importantly, I'm really focused for the rest of the day. I know what I want to achieve. You know, my job's transformation. My job, you know, I got to start thinking about change and how to make things happen. That hour and a half in the morning is just magical. It's mine and it's mine alone. And so if you could learn that early in your career, you'll be so much more happier as a person and more impactful as a leader.
Which I think is fantastic closing advice and kind of resonates with some of what you said before. There's an intentionality component to it. So you're not on autopilot, but that you are kind of intention, not just at a high level, but every single day. So Michelle, thank you so much for such a fantastic conversation of sharing your stories and your insights. Thank you for being on our Learnings with Leaders podcast.
Thank you so much. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation with you. Thank you.
And that's our show. Like what you've heard, please subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcasting platform. For show notes about this episode, links to things mentioned, or requests for sponsorship, visit pgalums.com/podcast. Follow us on Twitter at pgalumpod. We'd love to hear from you.
Learnings from Leaders is a production of the P&G Alumni Network, a global nonprofit founded by former P&Gers committed to community, enrichment, and philanthropy. With more than 45,000 registered members worldwide, the network connects alums through global conferences, local chapters, industry events, and online content. Our nonprofit foundation supports economic empowerment in communities around the world. To find out more, visit pgalums.com.
Now, here's a preview of next week's episode.
The assignments that will mean the most to you in the end are not necessarily the ones that were the most successful or where you had more tailwinds. The assignments that sometimes define you the most, mark you the most, and you take greatest pride in is the challenges that you face and being able to overcome them. Let's say, of all the things that I was a part of at P&G, the one that I'm proudest of was the time viewed as one of our greatest failures and how we dealt with it.
That's it for this week. I've been Andrew Tarvin.
And I'm still Ruman Segal. Thanks for joining Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. We'll see you next time.